move and the clock struck 1 in the morning. He and Fergie had decided to stay open to honor his brother. The bar filled up early, people standing shoulder to shoulder, wanting to pay their respects. Out front, someone left a tall candle flickering at the curb. There were several bunches of flowers, too. Drugstore roses, the petals tinged brown, tulips in clear plastic sleeves. It was closing time, but Brian and Fergie didn't tell anyone to go. The bar was boiling hot, even with the door cracked, even in January. Men's long sleeves were rolled to the elbow, and women's hair pulled up off their necks. Sweat pooled at their temples. Brian tried to float on top of the voices. Whenever someone offered to buy him a shot, he threw it back like it was the antidote that would save his life. Still, he couldn't keep the thoughts from rushing in. He came out from behind the bar now and made his way toward Patrick's office, pushing through the crowd. He'd been working up the courage to go back there all night. As soon as he was in, Brian closed the door. He switched on the light, looked around. He was looking for a note, even as he hoped there wouldn't be one. A note would settle it. There was an old slip of paper taped to the desk, printed with the last lines of the act of contrition. I firmly resolve, with the help of thy grace, to sin no more and to avoid the near occasions of sin. It was a joke. That was what Fergie called Patrick sometimes, the near occasion of sin. There was a bottle of whiskey, with only a thin coating of brown liquid left at the bottom. Brian picked it up, turned it over in his hands. Yesterday it seemed like nothing special. But now the memory of it would be more important than any other day. Patrick still here. Nora not yet transformed into whatever her grief would make of her. Brian should have insisted on driving his brother home, or forced him into a cab. He would regret it for the rest of his life. That was why he'd run off when his mother told him the news. He couldn't face her. How could a drive Pat had made a million times before end like that? How could someone so entirely alive just disappear? Brian's mind hadn't yet accepted it as fact. He closed his eyes, determined to focus. He would go over every second of Patrick's last day, find the signs, as if he might change the outcome if he got it right. "Start at the beginning," he said out loud. Fergie opened up on Sundays. Brian wasn't due at the bar until 6. He woke with vague plans to do a few chores for his mother. She had been after him to dust the ceiling fans and put the boxes of Christmas decorations back in the attic. He assumed the smell of bacon floating up from downstairs was an incentive to make sure he followed through. He got out of bed at 9, showered, put on a polo shirt and jeans. Then, as he did every morning, he went to the kitchen, ready to be fed. Nora stood at the stove, her back to him. Brian kissed her on the cheek, sat at the table, and picked up the newspaper. He pulled out the sports section. She set a plate in front of him. "Are you coming with me to the 10 o'clock? She said. "It'll be Father Callahan, I think." "Not today," he said. "I've got too much to do." He had been avoiding church for weeks. Whenever he went, he saw his old high school coach. O'Leary would give Brian the eye, tap his watch, a reference to a conversation they'd had after Mass a few months ago. When do you plan to retire? Nora had asked.
As soon as your son agrees to take over for me, Coach O'Leary said.
He followed up the next day by phone to say that he had been serious. Brian had no interest, but Nora never stopped bringing it up. She had even gotten Patrick on her side. She gave Brian a disapproving look now, but she didn't push it. While she was gone, he masturbated. He watched the Celtics game he'd taped the night before. He took a nap. In the afternoon, he played Grand Theft Auto in his bedroom for 3 hours, until his mother called up, "Four!" Brian hit pause. He was the only one of them who had ever lived alone with Nora, her fourth and youngest child. The number four was written into all the tags on his clothes when he was a kid, and even now when she wanted him, it was, "Four, time for dinner. Four, can you change the light bulb in the hall?" "Yeah?" he called back. "Did you do the boxes?"
"Yep."
He got up and did the boxes, the ceiling fans as well. Before he left for work, they shared a dinner of leftover chicken.
"You're closing tonight?" she asked.
He nodded. His mouth was full.
"What time?"
"One," he said. "It's always one, you know that." "But I don't like it."
"So you're hoping the answer will change if you ask me enough times?"
"I suppose so." They smiled at each other. She took a bite of her chicken, chewing it slowly, then taking a long sip of water.
"I was over to see your Aunt Kitty after church," she said. "Brought her her groceries. She said your cousin Connor was there for a visit yesterday with Marie and the kids. Isn't that nice? He belongs to the Hoosick Club in Milton. They were on their way there for lunch. Did you know he's going to retire this year? At 50, and with a good pension. That's what Kitty said. It seems like a nice way of life, being a policeman."
He gave her a look.
"Ma."
"What?" she said. "I'm only making conversation." A few minutes later, he was in the driver's seat of his car, waiting for it to warm up. Her car was parked in front of his in the driveway. For the first time in a while, Brian noticed the shadow of a bumper sticker long ago scraped off, but for the letters N-D-I-N. He looked away, then backed up into the street. When he reached the bar, there were only a few of them there. Joe by himself today. He was usually with George and Wally and Dick and Ed, a crew of white-haired guys with booming laughs who had lived their whole lives in this neighborhood. They came when it was Dan O's, and they came when it was Colony, and they came when it was Rafferty's. No allegiance to any particular name on a sign, only to one another. Two seats down from Joe was another old-timer Brian didn't recognize, a guy with a bald head and a white T-shirt, a combination that put him in mind of Mr. Clean. A young couple sat in a booth. The girl craned her neck to apply lipstick in front of the mirrored wall. The bathroom door swung open, and a guy in a Tom Brady jersey stepped out.
"Hey, QB, big game tonight?" Fergie said.
"Screw you, Ferguson," the guy said.
They laughed. Brian had come to relieve Fergie, but Fergie didn't go home. He never did. Instead, he poured himself a beer from the tap. He had the Herald folded in his back pocket. He opened it up, took a seat, and spread the pages out in front of him on the bar. He had been Patrick's closest friend since kindergarten. They made a funny pair. Fergie was short and bulky, with shaggy blonde hair that he could never seem to figure out what to do with. Next to Patrick, tall and handsome, all thick black hair and broad shoulders, Fergie looked like a disheveled kid.
Patrick had a mustache now, a strangely unflattering choice. On his 48th birthday, he'd partied too hard, gotten wasted, fell face forward into a bar stool. He ended up with a cut above his upper lip and then a tiny scar. The facial hair was meant to hide it, but Brian thought the scar would have been the better option. Fergie loved to give Pat shit about that mustache, as if it had put them on an even playing field, looks-wise, for the first time in their lives. A girl came in. She looked about 12, but she was wearing a UMass hoodie. 21, 22 max, Brian thought. He was all ready to ask her for ID when she said to him, "Can I hang a flyer for the Brendan Moynihan 5K? "Of course you can, sweetheart," Fergie said, pointing to the door she'd just come through without looking up from his paper. The back of the door was plastered in flyers, the Eddie Farrell Memorial Golf Outing, the Terry Sweeney Foundation Auction, the Sons of Aaron Fireman's Funeral Fund Barbecue. They watched as the girl added hers to the mix.
"That's a lot of dead Irishmen when you think about it," Fergie said.
At 6:30, Patrick arrived. The energy changed, as it did whenever he entered a room. It was like a famous person had just walked in. Pat came behind the bar and filled a pint glass with water. His rule was that they could, and did, drink their faces off anywhere else, but not here. Even when they were off the clock. Though Pat rarely mentioned that to Fergie.
"You see the new place finally open across the street," Fergie said. "Dottie's Wine Bar."
He held a hand straight up and then tipped his fingers forward.
"I saw," Patrick said.
"Dottie's," Fergie said. "On Dot Ave. Aren't they clever?
Won't last 6 months, mark my words."
Patrick shrugged.
"Eh, good luck to him. Maybe it'll keep the yuppies out."
His bar was an old-school dive, 5 blocks from the house where the family lived before Brian was born. The front windows were small. The room was as dark at lunchtime as it was at midnight. Pat had it set up exactly the way he wanted it. A long wooden bar, red leather banquettes, a concrete floor, a pool table and a dartboard in the back. A jar of pickled eggs on the bar, which nobody ever ate. Cash only. Pat loathed the thought of anything trendy. His motto? No frills, no food. They would not serve pressed sandwiches or have karaoke on Tuesdays. They would stick to the basics. It had taken Brian 3 months to persuade him to stock a beer besides Bud, Bud Light, and Guinness. He suggested Blue Moon.
"Girls like it," Brian said. "Trust me."
Pat only acquiesced after an arm-wrestling best of three that left Brian's shoulder aching for a week. That Patrick had gotten the place was something of a miracle. He never forgot how lucky he'd been. When their father was still alive, he came to watch the Patriots games on Sunday afternoons. Sometimes Nora came with him and ordered a cup of tea.
"Does it feel like a pub back in Ireland, Ma?"
Patrick asked her. "I wouldn't know," she said. But Brian could tell she was proud. The bar was usually full of Pat's old friends. They knew him from high school, from Little League, from Florian Hall, through a cousin's friend's cousin who had dated him in 1989.
"Bri," Pat said now, "look alive."
Joe had lifted his empty glass. He was the only one who ever ordered red wine, but Pat kept a bottle of Cabernet under the counter just for him. He had a soft spot for the guy. Joe had 2 grown sons who wouldn't give him the time of day. When his gallbladder ruptured, Pat was the only one who went to visit him in the hospital.
Brian found the bottle, refilled Joe's glass to the top as he knew his brother would.
"Sorry for the wait," he said.
"What do you make of this, Raff?"
Joe responded, pointing to the TV over the bar. Brian hated when they called him Raff, a name from another life. He looked up. A blonde ESPN anchor in a short skirt was interviewing a Red Sox pitcher recovering from Tommy John's surgery.
"He's done.
He'll be out for the season," Brian said. Mr. Clean, two seats over, looked at them, wanting into the conversation.
"I wouldn't be so sure," he said. "It's January. The kid's young. He'll bounce back."
"Careful there, buddy," Pat said. "That's a former pro ball player you're talking to. My brother used to play for the Cleveland Indians."
He still sounded proud after all these years. The guy looked impressed.
"Is that right?"
"Not exactly," Brian said.
"Double A," Pat said.
Even that was a stretch. Brian was only there for two seasons before they moved him down to single A, where he stayed for the rest of his career.
"What position did you play?"
"Second base."
"A five-tool player, this kid," Pat said. "All muscle. What did you have, 8% body fat?"
"Wouldn't know it to look at me now," Brian said, to get out ahead of what he assumed they were thinking. He had gained 60 pounds since he was in peak shape. He never worked out anymore. He let his body get a little flabby, embraced the slight beer gut as an occupational hazard. He thought once that baseball was his whole life before him, but it was just a moment, that was all. He would have preferred never to talk about it again, but the guys at the bar were obsessed. Most days he let them have their way. When you had lived the dream of everyone else, you weren't supposed to tell them the truth. If they thought you had gotten the best and still couldn't be happy with your lot in life, what shot in hell did they have? Brian was drafted straight out of USC. That first year, every bit of it was a joy. 10 hours a day outside, 40 degrees in Akron in April, and he was thrilled. He made less than minimum wage. He only got one day off a month, traveled by bus, lived in a motel room with no fridge, no stove. He ate mostly fast food and peanut butter sandwiches. They all did. Hope kept them going. They were in purgatory, but at any minute they might be released up to heaven. Double A was full of guys on their way to the big leagues, or else guys who'd come down from the majors for a while to recover from injury. There were a few who moved down further from there, but Brian barely took note of them. He assumed he would only go in one direction. Then he tore his Achilles in the second game of his third season. They moved him down.
"Just for now," they said.
5 years in Peoria, Illinois. 5 years of sleeping on a sofa in a one-bedroom apartment shared by seven guys. 5 years of being told that his body was a machine that required the highest-grade fuel when he could barely afford a Big Mac. Everything extra went on a credit card. He would think about it when the season was over. Brian still loved to play, but there was no dignity in it anymore. Single A was all about stunts to fill the seats. Once a season, the team brought a live camel into the park. Every night between the third and fourth innings, four guys dressed as a hot dog, relish, ketchup, and a French fry ran clunky laps around the field, racing to the finish. The crowd screamed out for their favorites, louder than they ever screamed for any player. They didn't get too used to anyone,
since they knew a guy might be called up any time. When kids were waiting for him outside the park, wanting his autograph, or standing over the dugout, gloves in the air, their faces saying that if he just tossed them a ball, it was all they'd ever need to be happy, then Brian felt like he had made it. He'd arrived. But the gimmicks brought him back to Earth. They weren't there for him. They were there because it was SpongeBob SquarePants night. When he was home in Boston, everyone wanted the details. They asked what the guys in the clubhouse called him, and when he said Raff, that's what they all started calling him too. His father and his uncles and every guy at Patrick's bar had suggestions. Tell the coach he needs to move you up in the order. Keep your chin up. You're meant for the majors. You'll get there. They had no idea what it took to get there, how enormous the line was between really good and great. His fourth and fifth years, Brian got injured again and again, pulled a hamstring, hurt his back. For a while there, he liked his oxy a little too much. When Pat caught him popping pills far outside of the season, he said, "What are you doing that shit for? Knock it off." And Brian did. His brother's disapproval was more powerful than any 12-step program. By the time the team released him, 7 years in, he was done. His only shame was in thinking about Patrick and Nora, the two people who had been to every Little League game he ever played, every game at Hull High. He worried he was letting them down. In the off-season, Brian lived at home with his parents, helping Charlie out with painting jobs to make extra money. When his baseball career ended, he moved back in. It was supposed to be temporary, while he paid off the credit card debt. But he got lazy, or comfortable, or both. Then his father got sick. After Charlie died, Brian couldn't leave Nora alone in the house. He had been there ever since. Pat gave Brian a job at the bar, full time. "Until you catch your breath," he said. Somehow, 7 years had gone by. Everyone at the bar still associated Brian with baseball. They thought of him as their in-house expert. What he wished he could say to Joe now, but didn't, was that every mention of an active player filled him with jealousy, reminded him that in the end, he hadn't been good enough. So many ugly thoughts, but not a single one uttered out loud. The worst part was that he'd loved baseball more than anything since he was a kid. But now, he could hardly stand the thought of it. "Mulcahy!" Pat yelled at a guy taking a seat at the bar. Pat made a big show of going around, hugging him. Brian had no idea who he was, but that wasn't uncommon. The bar was Patrick's domain. "You're back," Pat said. "Just for a few days to see my mother. She had to have her hip replaced." "Jesus," Pat said. "Sorry to hear it. Give her my best. Tell her to call me if she needs anything after you're gone." "Thanks, pal. She's doing her physical therapy now. I'm stealing an hour away. There is only so much Judge Judy one man can take." Patrick turned to Brian. "Mulcahy grew up on Crescent Avenue with us. Moved out to Atlanta when he got married. Did you two even meet last time he was in? How long's it been, Mulcahy? 5 years? 6? You were here for your sister's kid's graduation." "That's right. Good memory." The guy had a Boston accent like Patrick, like most of them in this place. Their parents had Irish accents,
and Patrick had a Boston accent, and Brian had no accent at all. The family moved to Hull the summer before he was born. As a kid, he used to stand in front of the mirror talking to himself, pretending to sound like the rest of them.
"How's your sister doing?" Mulcahy said. "My sister was asking for her."
"She's good. She's still in New York running the animal shelter.
God love her.
She specializes in rehabbing pit bulls. You know, after they come out of the dog fighting ring or whatever."
"Jesus."
After college, Bridget followed a few friends to New York for the summer. She never returned. In the early years, she was going out with a group of retired cops every night, a band of tattooed vigilantes who called themselves the Angels. They got animals out of all kinds of hideous situations. Brian once had to leave the room as she told John about somebody's cocker spaniel left tied up outside the grocery store while the owner went in for milk, and later found by the Angels dead, with its mouth duct-taped shut.
"Used as bait in a dog fight," Bridget said. "Sick fuckers."
Sometimes a crackhead stole a 5-pound designer dog from a parked car, then sold it on the street. The Angels tracked the dog down. If someone left a dog out in the cold, they'd build it a doghouse. When the Angels rescued an animal, they brought it to a shelter. They never knew what became of it after that. Bridget said some of the shelters were great, but it was easier to get a cute puppy adopted than an older dog that had been through something. She wanted to open her own place, where the neediest cases would get the attention they deserved. She saved until she was able to do it. Nora seemed vaguely embarrassed by Bridget's work, but Pat bragged about her. He did a fundraiser for the shelter every year at the bar.
"And how's John?" Mulcahy said. "Does he ever bring the governor in here for a few rounds?"
Brian knew Pat wouldn't mention that the two of them hadn't spoken in a while. Every guy who came into the bar thought Patrick was his best friend. But he hardly shared anything about himself. He didn't trust people.
"My brother John's too good for the likes of us," Patrick said. "My brother John belongs over there at Dottie's wine bar."
Mulcahy laughed. He ordered a Guinness. Pat poured it himself.
"You know, John's name was in the Globe today, right?" the guy said, taking a sip from the glass when Patrick handed it over.
Pat shook his head. "You didn't see it?"
Fergie raised up the Herald.
"We don't read that rag around here."
"It was an article about that kid. What's his name? McLean?"
Mulcahy said.
"The one who just won for state senate. This whole story about how his best friend got robbed in high school and ended up blind. Do you guys remember that? Oh, man, it was awful. He was just walking down the street in broad daylight, and boom, these pieces of shit came out of nowhere. I think they stabbed him in the eye. Or did they shoot him?"
"Did they ever catch them?" Brian said.
"It was a bunch of black kids from Mattapan," Fergie said.
"I thought it was Whitey Bulger and those lowlifes," Mulcahy said. "The kid's father owed them." "Wasn't that it, Pat?"
Patrick shrugged.
"I don't remember it, to tell you the truth. I think maybe we'd moved away by then."
"Right," Mulcahy said. "I forgot. You left in 75.
"Yeah. How'd you remember that off the top of your head?"
He shrugged.
"Half the neighborhood moved that year."
The family had left soon after some judge decided to desegregate the Boston public schools by busing poor black kids from Roxbury into Southie and poor white kids from Southie into Roxbury. Neither side wanted it. Most of the kids who lived on Crescent Avenue in Dorchester went to Southie High. Patrick was one of them. He got bused for a year. and then the family went to Hull. From what Brian had heard, everything was bedlam that first year. Riots in the streets, people dragged from their cars and beaten to death. It was shameful now to admit that this was the reason they had gone away, that they had abandoned the old neighborhood. The family never talked about it.
"So what does this blind kid have to do with Rory McLean?" Pat said. "I guess he was homeless. Hard for the poor bastard to find work after what happened. Heroin got him. But Rory's been trying to help him get back on his feet, and he's making the whole opiate thing a big part of his plan once he's in office. Good guy, I think. My mother's crazy about him, even if he is a Republican. Her sister owned a triple-decker on the same block as Rory's parents for years."
"Leave it to Rory to save the day," Pat said. He had a strange look on his face. For as much as Patrick was the life of the party, he had an angry streak. He loved to fight. Once, at a crowded bar in Faneuil Hall, the girl he was with said she was pretty sure some guy had touched her ass.
"Which one?" Patrick asked.
She pointed, and he threw a punch just like that. Afterward, the girl said maybe it hadn't been that guy. She wasn't sure. Rory McLean had brought this out in him on the day of Maeve's confirmation. Pat got all worked up for reasons Brian couldn't understand. He assumed it had more to do with Pat's feelings toward John than it had to do with Rory, and Pat had been drinking all day.
"Well, if you'll excuse me, I've got to go in and pay some bills," Patrick said. "Customers prefer it when you keep the lights on. Great to see you, Mulcahy. Come back in before you skip town."
"I will." They embraced, and then Patrick walked toward the office, shut the door hard behind him. A few minutes later, the guy finished his drink and left. Fergie stared at the closed door of Patrick's office. Finally, he went over and knocked. But Pat didn't answer. And Fergie knew better than to barge in. Sometimes Patrick went dark. He went somewhere they couldn't reach him. In those moments, it was best just to let him go. When Patrick resurfaced, it was almost 8. The bar had filled in. A group of guys in their 20s dressed in soccer uniforms had just ordered a round of Blue Moons. Fergie smirked as Brian poured them.
"Ah, the Brian special," he said.
Pat came behind the bar. One of the soccer players held out his beer, still foaming at the top.
"Excuse me, sir," he said. "You wouldn't happen to have an orange slice?"
Patrick looked around like he had the wrong guy.
"No," he said finally. "I don't have a fucking orange slice. Get the fuck out of here."
Brian raised his eyebrows as the kid skulked back to his table. Fergie doubled over, laughing.
"Christ," Patrick said. "Great. Now I can't remember what I came out here for."
He went back into the office.
"Is he shit-faced?" Brian said.
"What? No, I think he's just fired up."
An hour later, at 9 on the dot, Brian called the house to check on his mother, as he did every night. He worried about her when she was home alone. He pictured her up in the den, reading one of her mystery novels, oblivious to the madman trying to break in downstairs.
"Did you lock the doors?" he said when she answered.
"Of course I did."
"What are you doing?"
"Reading," Nora said. "Or trying to. There's something funny going on with the boiler. Will you have a look in the morning?"
"Sure."
"Why are you talking so softly?" "I have a tiny headache, but I'm fine."
Patrick came out of the office again, shouting Brian's name.
He's on the phone with his girlfriend, Fergie said.
Brian gave him the finger as he answered his mother.
Why don't you take an Advil?
He didn't know why he bothered to say it. He knew she would act like he had just advised her to smoke crystal meth.
You know I don't like to take that stuff, Nora said. I don't want to get dependent.
Tell her I'm going to send my ironing home with you tomorrow, Pat said. Christ, you two have got to be the oldest mama's boys on the planet, Fergie said. We should call the Guinness World Records people.
The woman does a crease like none other, Pat said.
It seemed like whatever was bothering him before had subsided. He sat at the bar beside Fergie, looked up at the TV. As Brian said goodnight to Nora, he noticed that Patrick's eyes were half open, as if he was dozing off.
Did you have a couple before you got here, buddy? Fergie said.
Patrick didn't answer.
Fergie raised his voice.
Hey, Tom Selleck, I'm talking to you.
Brian didn't hear his brother's response, because at that moment, Ashley Conroy walked in. She came straight over, leaned across the bar, and kissed him.
Fergie and Patrick and even old Joe whooped and oohed like a bunch of girls in the sixth grade.
Brian could feel himself blushing. He poured her a rum and coke. Ashley was a cute blonde, a slightly trampy dresser, several years younger than him. They met 4 months ago at the bar while she was out on a pub crawl for a friend's bachelorette. That first night, he watched her move through the room, every part of her bouncy yet firm, the perkiness of youth. While her friends did a round of tequila shots, she collected 5 business cards in rapid succession, got a guy to take a condom out of his wallet and give it to her, and drew an anchor tattoo on yet another guy's arm with a Sharpie. After each interaction, she crossed something off a piece of paper in her hand. She noticed Brian looking and came straight toward him. He looked away, pretended to be wiping down the bar with a rag.
"Give me your underwear," were her first words to him.
"Excuse me? Oh, let me take a shot off your stomach?
It's for this scavenger hunt we're doing. I was late joining my girlfriends at the last place, so they've given me a 10-minute head start here. Just trying to make it count.
Your name's not Jordan by chance, is it?"
He laughed, befuddled.
"No."
"Well, can I at least have your phone number? That's an easy one. It requires nothing of you, but it's worth 7 points.
"Why not?" he said.
He ended up going home with her that night. Brian didn't think she was all that smart, but then no one had ever mistaken him for one of the great minds of our time. He had never figured out how to match the words he said with what he was thinking. People at the bar joked that he was quiet because Patrick talked enough for the both of them. Maybe Ashley had as much going on in her head as he had in his, even though she only ever talked about celebrities he'd never heard of and the secrets of friends he'd never met. She wanted a commitment. Twice now, she had asked him for a state of the union. Both times, Brian succeeded in ignoring the request. He wasn't half as good-looking as Patrick, but Brian didn't have much trouble meeting girls. The fact that he lived at home with his mother ruled out most women his own age. But the baseball thing helped. That and the way he was so often silent. A girl with enough imagination could project anything she wanted onto him. Women were crazy about his brother. As soon as one was hooked, Pat was on to the next. Brian supposed he had taken this approach as a model without meaning to, though for him it felt temporary. When he was playing ball, he never lived anywhere long enough to make a commitment. Eventually, he would settle down,
He was still young, 33 to Pat and Fergie's 50. As much as he aged, so did they, so that by comparison, Brian felt like a kid. Things were slow for the rest of the night. At some point, he noticed that Patrick was no longer there. He thought maybe his brother had left without saying goodbye, or gone to the corner to get a slice of pizza. At 11:15, Ashley said, "Is he okay?" He turned to see Patrick stumbling out of the office in his coat, car keys in hand. Pat looked back at the floor behind him with disdain, as if it had tripped him on purpose.
"Christ, Fergie, clean that up."
"Clean what up?"
"There's some shit on the floor. I almost broke my neck."
"I'm off the clock," Fergie said.
"Well, clean it the fuck up anyway."
Fergie looked at Brian. He made a face that Patrick couldn't see.
"I'm heading out too," Fergie said. "I'll drive you."
"No, I'm gonna drive myself. I have my car here."
"Pat," Brian said, "let him take you. I'll put the car in front of your place later. Here, give me your keys."
"I need my keys to start my car," Patrick said, the words coming out extra slow, a revelation. He dropped the keys on the floor.
"Okay, man," Brian said. "No way in hell you're driving."
"What the fuck are you guys talking about? I haven't had a drop."
Patrick was so indignant that Brian almost wondered if it was true. Before anyone could reply, Pat scooped up the keys and was out the door. Fergie followed behind.
"See you tomorrow," he called to Brian.
A minute later, he was back.
"That asshole pushed me down," Fergie said with a mix of amusement and disbelief. "Your brother is stubborn as a mule, I swear to God. Well, good thing he doesn't have far to go."
They laughed. The night went on. When Brian was cleaning up before close, he noticed a glow emanating from below the office door. He went in there to turn off the lights. There was an empty whiskey bottle on the desk, but he didn't think much of it. By then, Patrick was gone. The space between 2 days could be a lifetime. 24 hours later, Brian stood alone in the office, whiskey bottle in hand, trying to block out the noise from the crowd of mourners outside. He wouldn't go back to his mother's tonight. After they closed, he'd go to Ashley's apartment, which would only be slightly more bearable. Ashley and her roommates would moon over him, asking again and again if he felt like talking. The one thing that might make him feel better would be fucking Ashley in the dark, the smell of her lotion like candy, forgetting for a few minutes. After, he would have to lie there listening to her tiny snores, remembering again. But still, it was better than going home. He knew it might cost him later, that she would make it mean something. But Brian was willing to deal with that when the time came.
Part 4, 1958 to 1967. Chapter 10. In the months before her wedding day, Nora wished she could confess to Una all that had happened since they arrived in Boston. They had promised to write every day, and they did, at first. But after a while, they both slowed down. Things got busy. A letter took an age to arrive. By the time you sent one and got one in return, everything you'd written had ceased to matter.
There were things she didn't dare put in writing. If they were together, Nora would tell Una about that kiss on the boat. She would tell her how she was careful around men after that, and about the last dance she went to on Dudley Street. How a sailor pulled her up from her chair, not listening when she said that she didn't feel like dancing. When they moved together, he sent currents through her, a sensation she had never felt with Charlie. She knew it was wrong. She went to confession. She stopped going to the dances. Nora scolded herself. She was shy and dull and ought to feel grateful that someone wanted to marry her. But when Charlie came upon her alone in the hall at Mrs. Quinlan's and kissed her neck in rapid motion, like a woodpecker tapping on a tree, her body tightened up in refusal. She had once thought a husband was secondary to so much else in life. But when she saw the way Lawrence and Babs looked at each other, laughed with each other, Nora understood that she had been wrong. All around her, young people seemed to have love like that, a kind of love she hadn't known existed outside of a movie screen. She was furious with her father for making her come, furious with herself. She never should have agreed to it. Her reason for being with Charlie was gone, and her distaste for him mounted with every bad joke, every booming laugh. Nora's stomach cramped whenever he mentioned a wedding. Mrs. Quinlan said she couldn't understand why they were dragging their feet. She didn't feel right having an unmarried couple living under her roof, even if they were on separate floors. Still, Nora delayed and delayed, claiming homesickness and later nerves about everyone looking at her. She knew that she would leave him. She could even convince herself that it was the kindest thing. There was nothing wrong with Charlie. He could find another girl, a better girl. He claimed he wanted Nora. But she didn't believe he thought there was anything so special about her. It was just that a plan had been put in place, and he would look foolish if it didn't come to pass. Nora knew she couldn't leave yet, but she fantasized that one day, after Teresa was settled, teaching, she might just slip off after work and disappear. She was 22. She could have a different life. She reminded herself to try to be grateful in the meantime. Her sister was doing well in school and would soon be a teacher. Teresa had only gotten the chance because of Charlie. They lived with his people, worked for his people. When Kitty told them about the mess Teresa had gotten herself into, everything changed at once. Nora saw her sister in the bedroom that night, looking the same as ever, and wanted to slap her. Her rage frightened her. She was afraid to speak. All that she had done for Teresa. How could this be the result? Nora's anger was a shield, staving off the guilt that threatened to consume her. Teresa was in this country because of her. She had wanted Nora to go to the dances, and Nora had refused for her own selfish reasons. A sailor. Imagine it. If she had gone along, none of it ever would have happened. For a short time, she convinced herself they could go on, with nothing but a slight delay in their plans. But the day she brought Teresa to St. Mary's, as they sat in that too hot office, looking up at the nun who would be Teresa's warden, Nora was struck. It was the way the nun spoke of the good Catholic family who would take the baby. Until then, she had only been thinking of her sister, herself. Now, she saw that there was a child coming.
She was ashamed to have brought Teresa to such a place. If their mother was looking down on them, what would she think of Nora now? The nun's words seemed to have no effect on Teresa. She only cared about Walter, about putting all this behind her and returning to him. Nora wished she could be as selfish, as irresponsible as her sister. Just let the baby go. Let them both go. She had given enough of her life over to caring for other people's children. But she sobbed in the car on the way home, hysterical in a way Charlie had never seen her.
"I never should have come here," she said. "I hate this city. I hate everything about it. I hate all the people."
She stopped just short of saying she hated him. Charlie gave her a sad smile.
"Isn't there anything you like about Boston?"
Nora thought it over.
"Brigham's vanilla ice cream," she said. "That's it."
Charlie said he would find Walter, convince him to do the honorable thing. And so they learned that Walter McLean was married, that he had a child of his own. Nora couldn't sleep for thinking about her mother, about her guilt, about the regret Teresa would feel later if she let this happen. She wept over it, but she knew what she had to do. There was only one way. She approached Charlie before breakfast.
"I'll marry you now," Nora said, "under one condition."
To her astonishment, he agreed. The nuns didn't like the idea. They said it was unorthodox, that a family had already been selected. "There's the issue of the fee we would collect from them," Sister Bernadette said.
"We'll pay it, whatever it is," Nora said.
They were married at the church the next morning, with only the custodian for a witness. Later they told everyone that Nora's shyness wouldn't have allowed for anything more extravagant. Standing at the altar in a simple blue Sunday dress, she could only look at the priest, not at Charlie. She thought of Lawrence and Babs, inseparable on their wedding day, Babs shrieking with delight at the sound of champagne being uncorked for a toast. Nora and Charlie moved to the top floor of a three-decker on Crescent Avenue. The rent was $100 a month. Mrs. Quinlan collected hand-me-down furniture for them. Each object carried the odor of someone else's home. The worn sofa smelled of pipe tobacco. The threadbare carpet was like an old dog. The families below were Charlie's cousins. Mr. Fallon, on the bottom floor, owned the house. The Sheehans lived in the middle. The wife, Christine, was Mr. Fallon's daughter. She had only been married 5 years, and already she had 4 children. They kept the doors to their apartments open at all times. Whenever Nora went up or down the central staircase, she had to greet them again, smile at their jokes and their invitations to come for tea. The bathroom off her kitchen had been converted from a pantry. Nora shook from the cold when she stepped out of the tub. Their bedroom was off the kitchen, too. There was a second bedroom down a long, narrow hallway by the front door, across from the living room. They were to keep this open for family coming over from Ireland. And there was a small dining room with pocket doors.
"You can change it to a bedroom after the first baby comes," Mr. Fallon said with a wink.
Nora was careful not to look at her husband. From the first night, Charlie wanted to make love, but she refused. This marriage was for a purpose. The outcome of what he was asking was too uncertain. It might lead them into even more of a mess.
"It's what married people do," Charlie said.
"I know, but I can't.
We could have the lights on.
Oh, Jesus, Mary and Joseph.
Or we could have them off.
Tomorrow, she said. But the next day came, and then the day after that, and she was no closer to being ready. Weeks passed. The longer they waited, the more tortured she felt. They slept in separate beds on either side of a nightstand. She lay there many nights, thinking of home, wishing she could go back. Not just to the house or to her family, but to her girlhood. As soon as they were married, Nora began wearing the loose-fitting sack dresses Babs had worn throughout her pregnancy. At work, she complained to Mrs. Byrne of nausea. She placed a hand on her stomach, feigning absent-mindedness, when she knew they were all looking. Nora sent Charlie alone to family parties, told him to make sure to say that she was tired lately and not feeling well.
"Aunt Nellie asked if you're expecting," he reported one night, and she saw that her plan would work.
She ran into Mrs. Quinlan at the chemist's, and Mrs. Quinlan said,
"Mrs. Byrne tells me you haven't been well."
"I'm in bed every night by 6, Nora said. "I've been sick to my stomach ever since we were married."
"You need to see the doctor," Mrs. Quinlan said with a knowing smile. "Thou shalt not lie," she had been taught since childhood, and since then Nora had obeyed. But she had never known how easy it was, how one lie could lead to the next, and the next, and the next. Every time she visited Teresa and eyed her sister's growing belly, Nora felt sick. She knew she had to tell her the truth, that Walter was married, that they would take the child. But it was so hard to say. Finally, they took Teresa to Hull, a town on the beach, to break the news. It was such a lovely night, and Teresa was in such good spirits that Nora couldn't do it there. She waited until the last minute, just before Teresa was due back at St. Mary's. The car ride was agony, knowing what she would have to say when they stopped. Charlie was nervous, talking under his breath to Bobby Quinlan, who wasn't there, but whose car they had borrowed for the evening. "Your tires are balder than your head, Bob," he muttered.
Nora told Teresa by herself. Up at the top of the stairs, beneath the porch light, before the sweeter of the nuns opened the door and said it was time for bed. Every night, Charlie flattered her. He begged, he made jokes, he stamped his feet.
"It's natural," he said. "Everyone does it. Please, for the love of God."
Nora wanted to die when he raised the subject. She wanted to fall through the floor and land on Mr. Fallon's fireplace and just disappear. She wanted to tell Charlie that she had never once heard a good thing about sex. Una said it hurt terribly, and the nuns at the convent school said it ruined a woman. And just look at Teresa. Nora had never spent so much time alone with Charlie. His jokes grated on her. His need to talk all night when she might have liked some peace and quiet. She was embarrassed by his presence when she was wearing her nightgown or brushing her hair, acts that had been private before. Once or twice a day, he came close to giving her a heart attack with his screaming. He'd shout, and she'd run to his side, afraid that something horrible had happened. From the sound of him, she'd think he had chopped off a finger, when in fact he had stubbed his toe, or read in a letter from home that his football team was out of the running for the season. If she could sit with Una for a minute, Nora would ask her what marriage was supposed to feel like. If Una felt the way she did, there was nobody here she could ask. Nora wondered
if another man would please her more, or if she was just being picky. Maybe it was always this way when you got up as close to someone as she was to Charlie. She imagined a soft-spoken husband who brought her thoughtful gifts.